and welcome to Worlds Apart. In the world of political matchmaking, the European Union has long claimed to put values above value creation, and that worked well for a while. But now that some countries can set up a whole new industry in the time it takes the EU to come up with a single policy decision, is that credo still satisfying for the EU own members? Well, to discuss it, I'm now joined by Luca Jair, the president of the European Economic and Social Committee. Mr. Jair, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Now, you often talk about the idea of a renaissance for Europe while also praising the enormous success of the European project. If it's been so successful, why does it have to be reborn?
So, let me see that you have to come back to a more long-term historical view. A period could have been enormously successful as many historical period of past empire that had been totally lost, dead, or disappeared, but they could arrive to an end, and they need to a new start. So my concept of Renaissance came exactly with what happened at the end of the Middle Age. You know that in the usual narrative, many are used to say that the Middle Age was a dark age. It was exactly the opposite. It was a fantastic and open age, capable to invent, to open, but it was right to an end. And so the end of this fantastic historical period could have dealt to a dark age. And there was a moment of change of the history. Yes, there are sometimes acceleration, change, where all the perspective are open. Look to what happens today with the UK, its incredible history, the Brexit, and the entire leadership of a country that seemed totally lost.
Well, there are many other countries that follow similar track.
This one
may not be completely. But it's interesting, let me focus on this idea of Renaissance, because many historians, or at least some historians, believe that Renaissance wasn't an original form. It was more sort of nostalgia for classic antiquity. And what I hear you saying is that your idea
this was one of the four pillars of this issue. There was a need to come back to some fundamental value to understand a transition in society, a transition in
economy. I understand, but are you saying that you are essentially driven by this nostalgia for the good old days that the European Union had?
No, the question is that if we are not capable to feed the idea of the future with a clear revisiting of the fundamental root where we come. And that has been Renaissance. The first issue that has been put in society was the need to come back, yes, to come back to the classical culture and to put the classical culture back in the public space of the debate. The second idea was a positive regard towards the technological change. And the symbol of this synthesis of these two first elements has been Leonardo da Vinci. He understood that technological change could have been
put. Well, that's exactly where I want to take this conversation forward, because many critics of the EU have absolutely no issue with Europe's past. They recognize the enormous success of the European Union. You often say that reconciliation and peace are its greatest achievements. Most of the people agree with that. They take issue that with the ability of the EU as a system, as a mechanism, to move forward, to be as efficient as it has to be in present times. Can you really do the renaissance without changing the way the decisions are made?
Yes, that's
in the EU?
That should be done.
How?
That's also a deal. And that's exactly what happens in the in this Middle Age, with these two elements of renovation has crossed with other two elements of renovation, because the good intuition and creation of the Renaissance, culture plus technology, should have been closed only in a closed region, the region of Tuscany and Florence, without the driving force of the society driver of this time was the merchant, the banker, and the second, the enormous capacity of renewal of the local government.
But Mr. Jair, you know that it happened many times in history that something that once was a blessing suddenly becomes a curse. Everybody agrees that at a certain point of time, the consensus model that the EU has served it well, but now it takes China less time to set up a whole industry than for the European Union to come up with a coherent policy. Don't you think that this mechanism of making decisions by consensus in this day and age when everything changes by the minute, is a bit outdated, to say the least?
Well, someone could think that is a bit outdated, but you know.
But how can you compete with China if it takes you years just to come up with a policy?
I think that democracy is still a very critical system, but is the last bud, at least the ones that allow to find, taking time, but conclusion and decision without killing millions of people. That has been the lesson that Europe has learned. Because, and it's been a very difficult lesson to learn.
Democracies can also be pretty agile in making decisions. They don't have to be a drag on society, right?
You know that today there are people that are thinking in Europe that it's better to sacrifice fundamental freedom to the capacity to decide. But after, there is what to decide to do. Because look to what happens in UK today. What has been promised by the Brexiter was simply not possible. And they know since the very beginning. So they sacrificed the liberty, the truth, the capacity to have a real and crucial democratic debate. And at the very end, they achieved nothing because they were totally incapable in this mechanism, even to drive
but
a change.
The same could be said about the European Union, especially when it comes to technology and the regulation of innovation. Are you saying that the Europeans have essentially a choice between either having a democracy or have an innovative, fast-moving society, technological society?
I think that this is a very good question, and this is the main challenge of today. Because the main driver of the technological change of today is artificial intelligence and digital. And this challenges two things of our society today. The first one is the possible reduction in the medium term of the workforce. And the second one is what is called how to maintain the human in command of this revolution. So there could be a way that some are following that perhaps tomorrow some command will be delegated to artificial intelligence, a human will become only the executor. And another idea that's much more cultivated in the West, that we have to find a new way to maintain the human in command of this technology.
In your presidency, you specified three priorities: sustainable development, peace, and culture. And all of them strike me as something that Europe does better than others. It's good at sustainable development, better than many other parts of the world. It's good at culture. It's definitely good at peace. If the renaissance, as you call it, is about moving forward, why do you focus on things that Europe already does well? Shouldn't you instead focus on something that it struggles at?
But I think that the idea to look to the sustainable development agenda is, first of all, I don't think that today Europe is the one that is delivering better than other, because, for example, China has not been at the forefront of this idea of sustainability. They were not the first to look to the situation of climate in Beijing, just to mention one. But today they understood that it is the future and they have been investing a lot in this. So Europe has been the inventor of this concept, has been the main inventor. Look also to the last directive has been approved by the Parliament about the banning of the plastic single use that can create enormous impact on climate, on the waste, but also can create an enormous business in producing new products on this. But other countries have understood that this concept is working, can create a new wealth. Europe can drive this agenda, not only as a theoretical agenda of thinking, but as agenda of change that will be a win-win agenda for finance, for enterprise, for micro-enterprise.
But how exactly can it drive it? Because one of the reasons why China is such a leader in all those areas that you mentioned is because it has streamlined decision making. Europe again cannot compete with that. So I keep going to the same question. Can you deliver that win-win outcome without changing the way the decisions are made in the European Union and the way they are implemented?
I think that for what Europe has to pay to its history, we can sacrifice some fast decision to some longer and participative mechanism. And when we think that we can bypass in European history, I will not to judge other history, because also someone has thought at the same moment it was denied that enormous development of market in China would change the system of China. And finally, we discovered that it's a state market economy that is winning the world. And is another concept.
And that is very efficient as well in raising standards for its people, lifting millions out of poverty.
But there is also a concept that in Europe will never work, and also in some part of the West Europe will never work, because to sacrifice at any price the individual to the collectivity will never work. In China, it's working from 1,000 years. It's a concept since the foundation of China by the Emperor Qin.
Is there any middle ground? I mean, we are talking not about major infringements on human rights or putting people into, you know, concentration camps or re-education camps. We are simply talking about streamlining policy on technical issues. Why those things could not be done in a more expedient way if you indeed want to compete with China, which is not going to sit around and wait for you?
Well, I think that is done. Look, for example, to the regulation of the trade agreement worldwide. Today, Europe has the double of trade agreement worldwide than the United States. So with our system, the complication of having 28 member states negotiating, but in any case, the possibility to delegate to one central negotiator. Today, Europe has the queue in front of Brussels of countries that want to negotiate with the European Union and not for single country. That's one example. The second example, Europe has been capable through this mechanism and not through the war, it was a unique case in history, to establish a current currency and to transform the euro as the second world current currency of reference, of stock, of security that is used by many. And even the Chinese want so much to enter, not only in the internal market that is the largest worldwide internal market, but also to base the balance of monetary security also with the euro.
Chinese,
these are two examples of enormous success of Europe with its mechanism of decision that seems very
complicated. I will provide a counter example for you, because just a few days ago, your own country, Italy, signed a memorandum of understanding with China to become an official member of the Belt and Road Initiative at a time when the EU hasn't even agreed formally on its new policy stance vis-a-vis China. It looks like your own country doesn't have much patience for this consensus model. It's clearly moving ahead.
Europe, someone can criticize this, but you know, Europe has always been built with this very difficult dialectics that has not been cancelled between the European consensus and a national interest that are still playing. It's not different from the case of France that also negotiated a big bill for selling, if I remember well, 300 Airbus to China as a bilateral mechanism.
So you see no problem with that, because there is definitely concern within the EU circles that Italy is striking out on its own here, because it's the G7 country. It's not the first country to sign that agreement, but it's the largest and one of the most important within the EU community.
I think that this is a challenge. I think that it is not only the acting government that has opened this. If you can remember, the opener of this Belt Road was Marco Polo, it was Venice, and was a two-direction road, not only the Italians and the European going to China, but also there was this delegation of high dignitaries of China coming to Europe and to visit Rome. And we have also to remember there was a large debate in Italy at the time of Romano Prodi, prime minister, that cannot be accused to be an anti-European, as you know for sure, for the role that he has played and continue to play, when there was an hypothesis to open an agreement for opening the port of Taranto and others to the Chinese. I think that has to be managed and to understood in a European framework, and something have to be criticized for, also by myself, for what my government has done, because I've not so been so transparent in the debate with the Parliament, has not opened all the documents to such a debate and a public debate. But in any case, in the agreement, the referral to the EU framework of the relation with China is very open, is very clear. So it's an ongoing debate. I think that we have to find a way to cooperate with China.
Well, let me stop you right here. We have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Young elephants have come to us after especially brutal poaching incidents, because sadly the baby elephants often do see their mothers not only be killed but also be cut up and butchered.
I do believe elephants smile. I see it in these little ones. Their whole facial expression changes.
After the previous stage of my career was over, everyone wondered what I was going to do next. They talked about different clubs. On one hand, it is logical to stay on your home field, where everything is familiar. On the other, I wanted a new challenge and a fresh perspective. I'm used to surprising people, and I thought, why not give it a go? I'm going to talk about football on RT. What else did you think I was going to do? By the way, where is the touchline here?
They're bred for a single purpose. They have a superpower. They start training very young. 8 months of intensive schooling. They're rats. And they save lives.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Luka Jair, the president of the European Economic and Social Committee. Mr. Jair, I heard you say that those who oppose the European project often do that without offering anything concrete. And yet, if we look at the Eurosceptics in your own country, Italy, they seem to be very resolute about what they want and what they don't want. They put the supremacy on the national legislation. They want to strengthen the Italian culture, the Italian national identity. They don't want more immigration or more austerity. Isn't that concrete enough?
I would look to this also from an Italian point of view, saying that Italy, without being part of the European Union, would not pass through the two major crises, economic and financial, one of the last 30 years. The one was when there was a big financial speculation attack in 92 against the liras and against the pounds, and Italy survived exactly thanks to the European framework. There was not a euro at this time, but without belonging to a perspective to go in a direction of more unification, more binding regulation on the monetary, Italy would have survived.
You understand that that's also a matter of debate, because there are some who would tell you that Italian gains of membership have been much smaller than among other member states, because if I'm not mistaken, the average GDP growth in Italy since 2001 was only a quarter of 1% compared to the 1.7 EU average. Can you really blame the Italians for trying to, you know, look at alternatives, for example, cooperating with China?
I think that when you speak about the Italians, you have also to make a fundamental distinction that there are, of course, fundamental argument for part of the Italian population.
Well, I'm talking about the current government, who has the support of and the mandate from the population. I mean, that's what I go by.
Yeah, but you know, it depends how you work the fears and the demand of people with concrete proposal. The acting government has, of course, the legitimacy to go, because they were voted and the other were pushed to the opposition, all the right and the left, as it happens in many European countries, because there is a big transition, as I was telling. There is a problem with the middle class fell lost in this globalization. So there is fears.
And you're blaming it on globalization. Isn't that also part of the EU problem? Isn't the EU, the way it's structured, the way it's guided, the way it defines its priorities, isn't that also part of the conversation? Shouldn't the EU be blamed for the rise of far-right parties across Europe? We are not only talking
anyone
about...
Anyone can blame everyone.
No, I mean, it's not blaming, but taking responsibility. Come on. People of neoliberal economic perspective have been in power for quite some time.
Everyone has to take responsibility in this very challenging time. And of course, there is a demand of transformation in our society due to the big and enormous transition that we are living, and the fact that we passed through the largest and the deepest economic and financial crisis. Yes, we have some tendencies that are going much more towards the coming back of nationalistic xenophobic attitude, but we came out without a major disruption. That's in any case one issue. When I'm saying that many of them are only saying no and they yes are absolutely not clear, the major example and the major lesson taken by all the populist sovereign is, for example, the Brexit. They say no for 3 years, they do not succeed, they're in the middle of nowhere, and you see that from 1 year, no one, either of the Italian leaders or the all the Italian or the European leaders of populistic and nationalistic party, are no more speaking about going out of the Eurozone and going out
of
Europe.
And yet
there is a reason for this.
Right-wing parties are still, despite Brexit, they are still in power in Italy, in Hungary, in Austria, in Poland. They are riding high in the Netherlands. They are riding high in France. It is expected that they are going to consolidate their presence in the European Parliament following the May elections. What is it in the policies of the EU leadership that is driving the support for those parties? I'm asking you to be critical in assessing, because you are ultimately in charge of analyzing those trends, and you have to take a hard look at the not only people you don't like, but also people you associate yourself with.
I think that what I was underlining, that the question that was very clear a few years ago when Farage and the Brexiter were taken as the champion of keeping back the control, and taking back the control, was the Steve Bannon idea, was the Salvini idea. All these narratives have simply disappeared from 1 year for all the speeches. They see that finally, not only this way to destroy European Union is not working, is not even supported by European citizens, is not even supported by their voters. And this is mainly important, describing that they have no...
But there, many of them remain in power, though.
But they remain in power because perhaps the other is not capable to make enough alternative. But the last poll are saying to us that most of them are not raising so much for the European election. What has not worked, from my point of view, are two main things. The ones that on one of the major challenges of this time, the migration challenge, Europe has not been capable to work out a common solution. And so there has been a major mistake, because a serious challenge has been transformed in the deepest crisis for Europe, because most of the nationalistic...
The crisis that were in part sparked by Europe's own decision to join forces with the United States in... wreaking havoc in Libya.
This has not been a decision taken by the European Union altogether. Some member states decided
The consequences will be suffered by all members. Is that fair? When you are not partaking, when none of you are partaking in the decision, but and yet you all have to suffer the consequences. Is it fair?
That's,
is it in keeping with the consensus model?
That's a good point. I've never been a fan of Gaddafi in the last...
that's not 20, a question of 20, what
20,
you think about Gaddafi.
Year, but of course... opening such a dossier without a clear idea on what next and the clear strategy to build up a structure after the destroying
and
of
without
this.
Any mandate from the international law, I mean from
and
the
without UNCQ. Any mandate, but unfortunately this is not the last, it will be done the next time. I hope that the international law can be a little more capable to control and to prevent this. Unfortunately, it has not been the case in the last 25 years, where many of the global players has decided to break by many issues.
You seem to be very resigned to international conflicts. I mean,
no, I'm not
haven't
resigning.
We had enough already?
I'm not resigning. I'm saying that we need to reinforce, to reinvest very clearly all together in the reform of the United Nations system as a key system to maintain peace and also to resolve by negotiation the major conflicts that still exist, and also the enforcement of peace where there are national conflicts that are making at risk a population.
Let me, since our time is running out, I still want to ask you a question about values, because the European Union has long positioned itself as a values-based entity, and about a decade ago, many Central Asian countries, for example, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, even Russia to some extent, wanted to deepen their cooperation, economic cooperation with the European Union, but they were told that, you know, we care a lot about values and you have to build your democracies first, and then the economic cooperation will deepen. They all turned to China, helping China rise, helping themselves, certainly. Do you think it was a smart decision putting values above economic opportunities, because China clearly have seized on those economic opportunities, some would say at the expense of the European Union?
I think that in the medium long term, the one cannot live without the others. It is exactly what happens at large in Africa, where Europe was accused to put too much higher conditionality to the aid that Europe has not cut, because the economic cooperation with all the continent, I have to say, there is no country that has been cut off. The investment and the external aid is still the first European Union plus the member state. But now most of them are saying that perhaps has not been a mistake in the time, because they need more money without conditionality. They look China as an opportunity. But today they are thinking they are sacrificing something important in the medium long term. So they are not deciding to interrupt this link, but they want to build up a new era of cooperation with Europe. And I hope Europe will be fair enough to understand this new challenge to build up a new joint partnership. I think that some mistake, to be very honest, has been done at a certain point, not only for the economic issue and values, but for the international geopolitics that has come back very strong in the international space between Europe and Russia, but not only between Europe and Russia, but also between Europe and Turkey.
Between Europe and the United States to some extent.
In this case, it's much more the responsibility of the United States, if I can say. The acting leadership has decided in an absolutely inconceivable way that Europe is becoming the worst enemy of the United States. So that's
Can I ask you one more question about values, because it's very interesting to me. You've been very supportive of President Macron's call to build a new European Renaissance, and some would say that you have to kind of put your own house in order before embarking on such grandiose plans. When it comes to values, what do you make of President Macron's handling of the yellow vest discontent? Was it in keeping with the EU values?
The discontent of the yellow vest were expressing some discontent, some explosion in the middle class. And from my point of view, perhaps also a big mistake of managing a major decision about the taxation.
Asking about the street action, because we are talking
about street action when you have people that are breaking or destroying everything.
On the other hand, you also have the use of explosive grenades and flashball weapons that maims and kills people. We are not seeing that even in authoritarian societies these days.
I have not seen many yellow jackets killed
at least 10 fatalities and several thousand injured. And people losing eyes, people losing their limbs.
You know, I think that is a little exaggerated, but I'm not here to defend it.
You think that it's fake news? I mean, you go and check Wikipedia. I mean, it's...
No, Wikipedia, I think, is not the best source of information, as you know. It's established beyond doubt that
those protesters have been heavy-handed.
No country can defend it except inside such a violent explosion of opinion. That I am very proud of how the Italian police is managing the extremists. Has not been the case in Genova 20 years ago, where something has happened, and after our justice, exactly due to the division of power.
I'm sure you would praise the Italian police force. I'm asking you about the French police force, though, because it's a very important question when you're debating values. Whenever some street action happens in other countries, authoritarian countries in the European book, there's always a very harsh criticism on any use of the police. But here we are not hearing that forthright response.
Sorry, but perhaps
European
we have different sorts of information. I've not heard. I thought about injured, because when there are such clashes, of course there are also people injured and big confrontation. But I've not heard about.
So you are not at all concerned about how the French government is implementing its values when it comes to
the yellow vest. I think there is a concern. There is concern that we have still either in each country, as we had in the past, for example, in Italy, or at the European level, the space to contest, to put in justice some attitude or some decision that were absolutely over the rules and not respecting also the right of the others. But we have also to say that there should be also a way either to prevent, and perhaps the French security forces to work a little more, if I can make a suggestion, take some lesson from others.
Well, that's a bit of a value stretching here, but Mr. Jair, we have to leave it there. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.